All right, let's jump into another deep dive. Today, we're tackling a topic that's, let's just say it's caused a lot of head scratching over the years.
Oh, yeah, this one's a classic.
We're talking about the servant of the Lord in Isaiah. Specifically, we're looking at chapters 50 through 53.
And based on the lecture transcript we're using as our source material, those chapters are packed with enough debate to keep scholars busy for, well, probably forever.
The big question, of course, is who this servant really is. Some folks think it's the nation of Israel going through some seriously tough times.
Others believe it points to a specific person, maybe even hinting at the Messiah.
It's a real puzzle, and honestly, that's what makes it so fascinating. So where does this lecture even begin to untangle all of this?
Well, it starts by digging into the servant's character, you know, what kind of person he's portrayed as. Isaiah 50:4-11 really paints a picture of someone who's willing to suffer, but at the same time, incredibly righteous.
So like the ultimate good guy, even when things get rough.
Exactly. But that's where the whole Israel is the servant idea starts to get a bit shaky.
Because let's be honest, Israel's history isn't exactly a straight line when it comes to being, shall we say, obedient.
That is putting it mildly. And the lecture highlights that tension by pointing to Isaiah 50:5, where the servant says, "I was not rebellious, neither turned backward."
That doesn't sound like a nation that's known for, you know, straying from the path a few times.
Nope, not at all. It'd be like claiming you've never missed a deadline when you're drowning in overdue work. Something just doesn't add up.
Right, there's a disconnect there. So how does the lecture deal with that contradiction?
Well, it brings up a really intriguing connection to the New Testament, specifically Luke 9:53, where Jesus is determined to go to Jerusalem, even though he knows there's going to be a whole lot of suffering waiting for him there.
Oh, interesting. So are they suggesting that this is foreshadowing, like a hint that Jesus might be the servant?
It's definitely presented as a parallel worth considering. It makes you wonder if there's a deeper connection there.
Okay, so we've got this mysterious figure who's willing to suffer but is also super righteous, and now there's a potential link to Jesus. Where do we go from there?
Well, just when you think you might be starting to get a grasp on things, Isaiah throws another curveball.
Oh, great.
What now? Isaiah 50:11 shifts the focus and addresses two very distinct groups. Those who fear the Lord and those who, well, don't.
So we're getting into the classic good guys versus bad guys territory. But wait a minute. I thought those who feared God were supposed to have it easy, like smooth sailing through life.
Not quite. And that's what the lecture finds so thought-provoking. It highlights this idea that even faithful people might find themselves walking in darkness, even though they're following God's guidance. It's like saying just because you've got a map doesn't mean you won't hit any traffic along the way.
That's a good point. Having faith doesn't mean life suddenly becomes a cakewalk. You still got to navigate the bumps in the road.
Exactly. And the lecture goes on to emphasize how the fate of those who trust in their own devices, well, let's just say it doesn't end so well. But that's a story for another time.
Okay, so we've got the righteous servant, a possible connection to Jesus, and now this idea that even faithful folks might face some serious darkness. What else does this lecture unpack?
Well, it takes us on a journey, so to speak, culminating in what it calls the climax of the servant's story, Isaiah 52:13-53:11. This section provides the most detailed and dramatic depiction of the servant's work and its impact. And there's a really important detail here. This is the last time in Isaiah that we hear about a single, singular servant.
Wait, so after this, it's like he disappears from the narrative?
Not quite disappear, but the language shifts. After this point, it's always servants, plural.
Interesting. So it's like the spotlight is widening, shifting its focus. What does the lecture make of this change?
Well, it definitely supports the argument that the servant might be distinct from Israel, acting on their behalf rather than literally being the nation itself.
Okay, so we're starting to see a clear distinction between the servant and Israel. But how did people interpret this whole servant idea back in the day?
That's where things get really fascinating. The lecture introduces us to the perspective of this Old Testament scholar, O.T. Alice. Now, Alice points out that while many scholars, even Christian ones, tend to view the servant as representing the suffering nation of Israel, that actually wasn't the original Jewish understanding.
Okay, so how did they see it?
Well, early Jewish commentaries, like the Targum of Jonathan, which is basically an ancient Aramaic translation and interpretation of the Hebrew Bible, actually identify the servant as the Messiah.
Interesting. So we've got this ancient Jewish tradition that links the servant to the Messiah.
Exactly. And the lecture suggests that this interpretation kind of got overshadowed by later interpretations that emphasized the suffering nation idea.
Okay, so we've got ancient Jewish interpretations pointing to the Messiah, later interpretations focusing on the suffering nation. Where does that leave us?
Well, it leads us to one of the most, I'd say, mind-blowing parts of this whole lecture, a mistranslation in Isaiah 52.12 that has had a huge impact on how people understand this passage.
All right, I'm all ears. Spill the tea on this mistranslation. What happened?
Well, the King James Version, along with a bunch of other translations, they kind of messed up the meaning of this verse. They missed some crucial nuances in the Hebrew.
Oh no, translation errors. Always a headache. So, what did they get wrong?
The Hebrew actually highlights this comparison between the astonishment at Israel's suffering and the disfigurement of the servant. And both of these, get this, lead to the sprinkling of nations.
Wait, hold on. Sprinkling of nations, that sounds a bit random. What's so important about that word?
That's where it gets really interesting. The word sprinkle connects back to those purification rituals in Leviticus. Remember, sprinkling was a key part of cleansing ceremonies in the Old Testament. So the idea here is that the servant, through his suffering, plays a role in purifying the nations.
Wow, that adds a whole new layer of meaning, doesn't it? But if the Hebrew was so clear about this sprinkling thing, why did so many translations miss it?
Because some scholars just couldn't wrap their heads around the idea of sprinkling in this context. They thought it didn't fit with their understanding of the passage. So they came up with all sorts of complicated explanations to avoid the word sprinkle, even though its meaning is crystal clear in other parts of the Bible.
It's like they were so focused on fitting the text into their own preconceived notions that they missed the obvious.
Exactly. And what makes this even more fascinating is that verse Peter 1.2 explicitly links sprinkling with the blood of Jesus Christ and his purifying sacrifice.
Whoa, now we're getting into some serious theological territory.
We are. And this mistranslation really highlights a key theme that runs throughout these chapters, the unexpected nature of the servant's mission.
You're talking about that rhetorical question at the beginning of Isaiah 53. Who has believed our report?
Exactly. It underscores how surprising the servant's path to salvation really is. It's not about conquering armies or worldly power, but about suffering and sacrifice. It's not your typical hero story.
No, not at all. So how does the lecture describe this unconventional path?
Well, it points to the description of the servant's origins in Isaiah 53.2. He's portrayed as a tender plant and a root out of dry ground, lacking any outward attractiveness.
It's like the opposite of what you'd expect from a powerful divine figure.
Right. It's a reminder that appearances can be deceiving and that true power might not look like what we expect.
That's a great point. So if the servant's path to salvation is so unexpected, it makes sense that people would have trouble understanding it.
Absolutely. And that's exactly what Isaiah 53.33 toward describes. People misinterpret the servant's suffering, seeing him as stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted, without grasping the true purpose behind his pain. They're focused on the symptoms, but missing the deeper meaning.
It's like they're so fixated on the suffering that they miss the bigger picture, the reason behind it all.
Precisely. And that misunderstanding is really crucial because it gets to the heart of who the servant is and what he came to do.
Mm.
And that, my friend, is a topic for part two of this deep dive. Picking up where we left off, that whole idea of people misunderstanding the servant's suffering, Isaiah 53.3-4, really drives that home. They see him as stricken, smitten by God, afflicted, without getting the point of it all.
You're seeing the symptoms, but missing the cure, like focused on the suffering, but not the deeper meaning behind it.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. It's like they're missing the forest for the trees.
Yeah.
And this misunderstanding, it's crucial because it goes right to the core of who this servant is, what he came to do.
So if the servant isn't suffering because of his own sin, then whose sin is he bearing? What does the lecture say about that?
That's the big question, isn't it? And the lecture dives right into it, gets into this idea of the atonement, the idea that the servant, he takes on the sins of others. Isaiah 53.5 puts it this way. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him. And with his stripes, we are healed.
Oh, that's pretty intense. So the lecture must have really unpacked that verse.
It did, definitely. It highlighted how that verse, it points to this concept of vicarious suffering.
Okay, vicarious suffering. That's one of those terms that always makes me go, huh, can you break that down for me?
Sure. Vicarious suffering, it basically means suffering on behalf of someone else. Like the servant is taking the punishment so others don't have to. It's like, imagine a courtroom drama. Someone takes the blame for a crime they didn't commit to protect someone else.
Gotcha. So the servant, he's like the ultimate scapegoat, taking the fall for everyone else's mistakes.
Yeah, that's a good way to think about it. And this idea, it's a cornerstone of Christian theology. It's the basis for the belief that Jesus' death on the cross, that it atoned for the sins of humanity, made it possible for people to have a relationship with God again.
Right. So this whole idea of someone else taking the punishment you deserve, this substitutionary atonement, it's pretty central to Christian belief. But how is the lecture, how does it reconcile this with all that talk about the servant's healing ministry? We're talking about two different kinds of healing here, right? Physical healing and spiritual healing.
You're right. It's a good observation. And the lecture, it addresses that directly. It points out that the servant's healing ministry, the physical healing, it's a sign, a visible sign of his power, his authority. It's like a preview of the even greater healing he'll bring about through his death.
Okay, I get it. Like those before and after photos you see in ads. But on a cosmic scale, the physical healing is just a glimpse of the complete spiritual restoration the servant offers.
Exactly. Like getting a sample at the grocery store. It gives you a taste of what the full product is like. Mm-hmm. And this idea, it's further emphasized in Isaiah 53.6, which says, "All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way. And the Lord hath laid on him the iniquity of us all."
Ah, yes. The classic lost sheep metaphor paints a pretty vivid image of humanity, you know, wandering aimlessly, lost in sin, separated from God. Like, think of those nature documentaries when a baby animal gets separated from its mother, totally lost and vulnerable.
Yeah, that's a great connection. And it's the servant who comes in, gathers those lost sheep, bears the burden of their sin, guides them back to the shepherd. The lecture, it really highlights how the servant's mission is driven by love, compassion, even though it leads him down a tough path.
Makes sense. But if the servant is truly innocent, why does he willingly go through this suffering? Seems kind of unfair, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's a question that's puzzled people for a long, long time. And the lecture, it explores this idea of the servant's, well, his silent submission, as it's described in Isaiah 53.7.
Whoa.
"He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He is brought as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shearers is dumb, so he openeth not his mouth."
That image of the lamb being led to slaughter, it's powerful, heartbreaking too. It really highlights the servant's, you know, his innocence and how helpless he is in the face of this immense suffering.
It's a powerful image for sure. And the lecture suggests that this silence, it speaks volumes about the depth of the servant's love, the unwavering commitment to his mission. He chooses to suffer so that others can be saved.
It's an act of incredible selflessness. But there's got to be some reward for this, right?
Oh, absolutely. The story doesn't end with just suffering and silence. Isaiah 53:9-12 describes the servant's ultimate triumph, his exaltation. It says, "Yet it pleased the Lord to bruise him. He hath put him to grief. When thou shalt make his soul an offering for sin, he shall see his seed, he shall prolong his days, and the pleasure of the Lord shall prosper in his hand."
So even though he suffers unjustly, the servant, he wins in the end. His mission, it's not in vain.
Not at all. The lecture really drives home that point. The servant's suffering, it leads to a new covenant. It's a restored relationship between God and humanity. And this victory is not achieved through, you know, force or power, but through self-sacrifice and love. His willingness to suffer, it brings about a transformation that, well, that wouldn't have been possible any other way.
It's like saying that real strength, it doesn't come from dominating others. It comes from humility, from compassion.
Exactly. And that brings us to one of the key takeaways from this lecture. The servant story, it challenges us to confront our own assumptions about power, about success. What if true greatness, what if it lies not in worldly achievements, but in, you know, selflessness, a willingness to serve others?
That's a deep thought. Makes you think about your own priorities, what really matters in life.
And that's where the lecture really pushes us to think critically. If the servant's humble origins, his suffering, if those were part of his mission to cleanse and redeem, what does that say about our own expectations? Our expectations of power, of success?
It's a good question. Makes you wonder if we sometimes miss out on opportunities for true greatness because we're too focused on our own comfort, our own advancement.
That's a really insightful observation. And it's that kind of reflection that this lecture is trying to inspire. The servant story, it's not just some ancient tale. It's a challenge. A challenge to look at our own values and consider how we can embrace humility, sacrifice in our own lives. What if by choosing to serve others, we unlock a deeper level of fulfillment, a kind of fulfillment we could never achieve just by chasing our own self-interests? It's a challenge worth thinking about, isn't it?
It really is. This deep dive is really making me rethink some things. But wait a minute. We're not done with the lecture yet, are we? There's still more to this servant story.
Oh, you're right. We've still got more to cover.
Yeah.
The lecture goes on to explore the legal aspects of the servant's suffering, his ultimate vindication. And that's where we'll pick up in part three of this deep dive. So we've talked about the servant's suffering, how it's all tied to this idea of atonement, him taking on the sins of others. But there's still this question of fairness, right?
Mm.
If he's innocent, why does he have to go through all this? It just doesn't seem right.
Yeah, it's like, where's the justice in that? The lecture must have addressed that, didn't it?
Oh, it definitely did. After laying out that whole concept of the servant taking on the sins of others, the lecture shifts gears a bit and dives into this question of justice, you know?
Mm.
Isaiah 53.8 asks, "He was taken from prison and from judgment, and who shall declare his generation? For he was cut off out of the land of the living. For the transgression of my people was he stricken."
So we're getting into the legal side of things now. It sounds like the lecturer is saying the servant got a raw deal. Like his trial and punishment were totally unfair.
That's exactly it. The lecturer points out that the servant was cut off prematurely, meaning he died before his time. And it wasn't because of anything he did. It was because of the sins of others.
It's like he's being punished for someone else's crime, which now that I think about it, that's the whole point of substitutionary atonement, isn't it? Someone else taking the rap.
Exactly. But it still brings up these tough questions about, you know, divine justice. How can a perfectly righteous person suffer for the wrongs of other people? Where's the fairness in that?
Yeah, that's a head scratcher for sure. I bet that question has kept theologians up at night for centuries. So how does the lecture approach this whole theological dilemma?
Well, it comes back to this idea of substitutionary atonement. Mm. The servant, he willingly steps in and takes the punishment that should have gone to humanity. He becomes this substitute, you know, bearing the weight of sin so that others can be set free.
It's like a legal transaction, but with incredibly high stakes. Instead of money changing hands, it's freedom from sin.
That's a great way to put it. And the lecture also points out this phrase, "Who shall declare his generation?" This question, it emphasizes the mystery surrounding the servant's identity. And it hints at the ripple effect of his sacrifice, how it goes way beyond his own lifetime.
It's like his suffering has this echo that goes through time, impacting generations to come. Pretty powerful imagery, right?
It is. And that leads to the final point the lecture highlights. The servant's vindication. Isaiah 53.1112 says, "He shall see of the travail of his soul and shall be satisfied. By his knowledge shall my righteous servant justify many, for he shall bear their iniquities. Therefore will I divide him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he hath poured out his soul unto death. And he was numbered with the transgressors, and he bare the sin of many, and made intercession for the transgressors."
So even though he suffers unjustly, the servant is ultimately rewarded, right? It's like a classic redemption arc, just on a much grander scale.
Exactly. The lecture makes it clear that the servant's suffering isn't pointless. He's exalted, vindicated. He receives a portion with the great and shares in this victory over sin and death. It's a powerful message of hope, you know.
Mm.
It reminds us that even when things seem unfair, good ultimately triumphs.
Wow, what an amazing deep dive. We've covered so much ground, from trying to figure out who this servant is, to the theological implications of his suffering, to his ultimate victory. It's been quite a journey, honestly.
It really has. Exploring these passages in Isaiah, it's always a fascinating experience. The servant of the Lord, it's captivated readers for centuries, and it continues to offer these incredible insights into suffering, sacrifice, and redemption.
I have to say, this whole deep dive has really given me a lot to think about. That idea that true strength comes from humility, from selflessness, that's something I'll definitely be reflecting on.
And that's the beauty of these ancient texts, isn't it? They raise these questions, these timeless questions that stay with us long after we're done reading. And like the lecture reminds us, the servant's story, it's not just an ancient tale. It's a call to action, you know. It invites us to examine our own values, to see how we can embrace humility, sacrifice in our own lives. What if, just imagine, what if by choosing to serve others, we actually unlock a level of fulfillment that we could never find by just pursuing our own self-interests? That's a powerful thought, isn't it?
It really is. It's a reminder that true greatness, well, it might not be found where we expect it. And that wraps up our deep dive into the servant of the Lord. We hope you've enjoyed this exploration and maybe even come away with some new insights. Until next time, keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep diving deep.